Good evening. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Library. I'm Stuart Baines, the Library's Assistant Director of Community Outreach. As we begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land. I thank their elders, past and present, for caring for this land we are now privileged to call home. I'm delighted that so many of you have come along tonight, and it seems to be a slightly different audience to a normal library audience, so that's excellent. Thanks for coming along and thanks for joining us tonight to hear from one of Australia's best-selling authors. Born in Melbourne, Garth was raised in Canberra, makes us one of our own. A full-time writer since 2001, he previously worked as a literary agent, a marketing consultant, a book editor, a book publicist, book sales representative, bookseller, and as a part-time soldier in the Australian Army Reserve. Garth's books include the award-winning young adult fantasy novels Sabriel, Liriel, Aborson, and Clariel, the dystopian novel Shade's Children, the space opera A Confusion of Princes, and a Regency romance with magic, Newt's Emerald. His fantasy novels for children include The Ragwitch, the six books of the Seventh Tower sequence, the Keys of the Kingdom series, and the Trouble Twister series. He also co-authored Spirit Animals, Blood Ties with Sean Williams. Quite an extensive collection. More than 5 million copies of his books have been sold around the world, appearing on the bestseller lists of the New York Times, Publishers Weekly, The Guardian, The Australian, and his work has been translated into 40 languages. Tonight, Garth will reaffirm that he is the master of the genre, delivering his long-awaited fifth instalment of the Old Kingdom series, Golden Hand. Please make welcome to the stage, Garth Nix.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's always good to be back here in Canberra, in my old hometown. I'm going to talk for a little while. I'm going to read a little bit from Golden Hand. There'll be time for lots of questions and hopefully answers as best I'm able. And I'm also going to read a little bit from Frog Kisser as well, a book I've got coming out early in March. And then, of course, we'll also have the giveaway for the Bell Charms. Brought my hat with me to draw from, so we'll be doing that as well. I was thinking, every time I come out on the road with a new book, and I've been doing this for quite a long time, I always try and think of new things to talk about, new things to say, because I kind of get tired of the performances that I do, the shows that I do when I'm talking about books and I'm on the road. So I always try and make things a little bit different. And I was wondering what I was going to say this time, what I was going to talk about, as well as doing the reading and so on. And one of the things that struck me is that I have been doing this a long time. And thinking about writing stories and storytelling, I cast my mind all the way back to actually when I was here in Canberra and I was a student at Turner Primary. And I was sorting through some things the other day and I found some of my old class photos. And it just prompted memories of some of the things that I used to do when I was at school. And I realised looking back that a lot of them actually showed that I was already thinking about stories, that I wanted to be a storyteller. And earlier today, coming over from the airport, we went past Turner Primary, my old school, past Turner Oval. And I remembered, and I'd almost forgotten this until we went past, I remembered that in probably about year 4 or year 5, I convinced half a dozen of my friends that we needed to treat the oval as if it was a pyramid, which we had to completely imagine, of course, because it was a large square of grass, and that over numerous lunchtimes, we slowly made our way into the centre of the pyramid. And it's only looking back it occurred to me how weird that must have looked to other people to have lines of kids where I'm going along in front saying, okay, now we're going down the narrow passage, you know, and they're all following along behind me. And now we've got to step over the pit. We'll go along the edge. And we did this, you know, over numerous lunchtimes, and really I was making up a story for them, a story that we all shared. And I wanted them to believe that story. I wanted them to believe we're in a pyramid, even though we're actually in the middle of the oval, you know, under that hot Canberra summer sun. And of course, eventually we got to the centre of the pyramid, and I'm sure there was a treasure or something we'd been aiming for. And then I said, okay, now we've got to get back out of the pyramid. And someone said, well, we'll just go back the way we came. And I said, no, we can't do that. not for actually story reasons, but because I couldn't remember how the hell we got into the middle in the first place. So the story had to go forward. The story couldn't go back. So I guess I've been telling stories for a very long time. And over the years, I've gone from pretending the Oval was an ancient Egyptian pyramid to writing stories, and I found a kind of, you know, socially acceptable way of being able to tell stories that doesn't get me into trouble and is actually seen as kind of useful, as opposed to making up stories that perhaps might involve more criminal enterprises, like trying to sell bridges to people or something like that, which I don't own, of course. Yeah, I've been doing this a long time. One of the other things that I did was I looked back. Most of my earlier books I wrote longhand first in black and red notebooks like this one. I've got many, many black and red notebooks on the bookshelf in my office at home. Sadly, I've also got one blue and white striped notebook when there was a stationery shortage and I had to buy some other books. But one of the things I did quite early on in these notebooks is that I'd write a chapter longhand first, and then I'd type up that chapter. So the first typed version would in fact be a second draft. I'd change it as I typed, then I'd print it out and correct it and carry on and so on. And when I'd typed that chapter on the computer, I would write the word count down and the date in the front of the book. I haven't actually bought any of those old ones with me this time. I did take the Sabriel one to the event in Kinokuniya in Sydney, but I didn't want to bring it with me to Canberra because I just didn't trust the people here. I was worried about taking it on the plane, and so I just let's say I would lose it and that would be a disaster. So I didn't actually bring it, but I did make a note of the things I used to write of the record I had of writing those chapters. And so I thought, when I got that Sabriel book out, that manuscript book out, I thought, I'll open it up and it will tell me exactly when I typed the first chapter of Sabriel. Because I'd entirely forgotten that when I, in fact, opened it, I saw that, for some reason, I didn't start doing it until chapter 5. But I can tell you exactly when I first typed chapter 5 of Sabriel and when I finished it. And I wrote Sabriel, the beginning of the Old Kingdom book, so the ancestor of this book. I typed chapter 5 on the 4th of July, 1993, probably before quite a number of you were born. And I finished it at 9:57 p.m. on the 20th of April, 1994. And it was published in 1995. So Sabriel is 21 years old in its book form. And it's great that it's lasted so long and it's kept going. And of course, it was the ancestor of all the other books that have followed it in the Old Kingdom series. Now, Golden Hand is also a continuation, of course, of Liriel. Of Liriel and Abhorsen, Golden Hand picks up the story 6 months after the end of Abhorsen. It overlaps with the novella The Creature in the Case, which is in my collection Across the Wall. And Liriel is again one of the main characters, though there is also a new main character, a woman called Ferrin, who comes from the far north, beyond the borders of the Old Kingdom to the north. And there's also Nicholas Sayer features in the book as well. So I thought I'd look back to where Liriel started. And Liriel actually has a slightly more complex history, because I originally wrote Liriel and Abhorsen as one book, which some of you may have gathered if you read Liriel and didn't have Abhorsen to hand. You probably got to the end of Liriel and went, bloody hell, that bastard. because they really are one big book. And I originally wrote them as one story, but it wasn't as long as the two books ended up being. And I started the first version of Liriel on the 10th of August, 1997. And I finished that on the 29th of April, 1998. I hope someone's writing this down for a PhD or something. No, there won't be a quiz, don't worry. I can't remember the dates. How could anybody else? And I sent it to my editor, Jenny So. It was actually my American editor was dealing with the books first. And she said, it's great, we could publish this as it is, but I would really like to know more about Liriel when she's a bit younger, because in its original form, Liriel started with her already a librarian, already 18, and went on from there. And I reacted in the usual way I react to editorial comments requiring enormous amounts of work by being very cross and irritable for about 24 hours. But having been an ex-editor myself, I knew that I should wait and not respond immediately with, "Don't be ridiculous, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard." And I thought about it for a while, and I realised that she was right. We did need to know more about the characters. And I went back and I rewrote the whole book, and I extended not only Lyrael's story, but also Samoth's story, and told much more about what happened before they met up. And that required almost another year of writing, so the book was finished in August 1999. So, you know, there's a lot of work before we got to Golden Hand. Many, many, many years of writing, and some backwards and forward steps before we got to Golden Hand. And so it was good just to look back upon all that. And of course, I had no idea where I was going when I started these books. Sabriel, I thought, was just a standalone novel. I didn't know I'd write any more in the Old Kingdom. But I've always been drawn back to it. I've gone away from it. I've written other books. But I've always been drawn back to the Old Kingdom. There's so many stories to tell in the Old Kingdom that I sort of can't help myself. I'm always coming back. So Golden Hand is the latest of the books in the Old Kingdom, number 5 in what is now the Old Kingdom series, no longer a trilogy or even a quartet, with Clariel, the prologue, coming out 2 years ago. And I thought I'd read a little bit from Golden Hand now. Again, going on tour, deciding what bits to read from books is always kind of tricky. And it often takes me 3 or 4 events before I work out which are the best parts to read, because I don't want to give you spoilers, even when you're going to read the book fairly soon. And so looking at this, I realise that I can only read the first 3 words and then I have to stop. So it's going to be very short. No, it's not going to be that short a reading. But there's various parts which I could read, because there's sort of 2 intersecting stories. And so we have actually kind of like several different beginnings. I've been reading the prologue in my previous events this week, but this time I actually think I'll start from chapter 2, which sounds counterintuitive, but we'll see how we go. It'll leave you able to start the book yourself completely fresh without hearing my voice lurking behind your mind as you read, which could be a good thing. This is chapter 2. 2 hawks bring messages. The hawk came down through the clouds, dodging raindrops for the sheer fun of it, despite having already flown more than 200 leagues. Born from a charter-spelled egg and trained for its work since it was a fledgling, the hawk carried a message imprinted in its mind, and with it the burning desire to fly as swiftly as possible to the Tower Mews in the royal city of Belisaire. The rain-dodging hawk from the south beat another bird flying in from the north by 30 minutes, so it was first to get to Mistress Finny, the chief falconer, while the later hawk had to be content going to the fist of an apprentice. As a matter of procedure, Mistress Finny checked the anklet on the bird to see where it had come from, though she already recognised him. She knew all the message hawks of the Old Kingdom, having raised them herself, even if they were later assigned elsewhere and became only occasional visitors to the capital. "From Wyverley College, my lovely," she said softly, making her own peculiar tongue-clicking sound, one all the hawks knew from the egg. "What a long way, and over the wall too, my brave one. What's your message, dear?" The hawk opened its beak and spoke with a woman's voice, that of Magistrix Coel, who taught charter magic at Wyverley College, in that strange land beyond the wall, where magic waned and then disappeared entirely, once too far south. "Telegram from Nicholas Sayer for the Abhorson, extremely urgent," said the hawk. "Ah, for the Abhorson," said Mistress Finny. "Messenger?" A 7-year-old page who hoped to become one of the falconer's apprentices leapt up from the bench where she sat with 3 others, waiting to take the messages the hawks brought in on the next part of their journey. "Yes, mistress?" "Find out where the Abhorson in waiting Lyrael is. Tell her I am transcribing an urgent message from Anselstier calling for the Abhorson, and ask her to either come here for it or to stay wherever she is, and you come back and let me know, and we will send it on." "Yes, mistress," said the girl, with a slight hesitation that suggested she didn't know where to look for Lyrael, or why she was looking for Lyrael instead of the Abhorson herself. "Try Prince Samoth's workshop first," said Mistress Finny, after a moment's thought. "I believe she's often there, for he is making her new hand." The girl bent her head in acknowledgement, spun on 1 foot, and dashed to the stairs. "Slow down," called out Mistress Finney after her. "You'll do no good if you fall to the bottom." The clatter of footsteps slowed a little. The falconer smiled and lifted the hawk to the perch that sat on her writing desk. The bird stepped off onto it, watching the woman as she took up her quill, dipped it in the inkwell, and made ready to write. "Now, my dear, give me the message," said Mistress Finney to the hawk, who once again spoke clear and loud in the voice of Magistrix Coel. Wyverley College, though it lay across the wall, was close enough that charter magic could be wielded there. Though its location meant Ancelsterian technology could not always be relied upon, a telegraph boy's bicycle would not fail. So it had become the de facto place for Ancelsterian telegrams to be transferred to Old Kingdom message hawks for onward delivery to authorities in the north. "Abhorsen, I've just received a telegram. It reads, 'To Magistrix Wyverley College, Nick found bad kingdom creature, Dorrance Hall, tell Abhorsen help, stop. This from Nicholas Sayer, stop via Danier's valet, Applethwick end.'" Now, Dorrance Hall is several hundred miles south, so this seems very unlikely, but I have heard it is some sort of secret government place, so perhaps should be investigated. I have sent telegrams to the Bain Consulate and the embassy in Corvair, but have not yet had an answer. The message ended suddenly. The message hawks were invaluable, but their minds were small and could not hold very long communications, and their capacity also varied from bird to bird. Unless you knew the particular hawk in question and counted out your words beforehand, it was easy to be cut off in mid-flow. Senders often forgot this in their eagerness to pass on important information. Nor, once a message was impressed, was it an easy matter to start again. "Well done, my dear," said Mistress Finney softly to the hawk, carefully drawing a line below the message she had just transcribed and initialing it MF. She gestured to one of her apprentices, who came and took the hawk over to its own perch to be fed some fresh rabbit and to have a drink. The apprentice, who had heard the message from the northern hawk, approached, passing over the paper where he'd written down that bird's missive. "This one's for the king," he said, "from the Greenwash Bridge Company at the bridge. Not marked urgent. Follow up to their earlier report." "Spike it for Princess Elamere," said Mistress Finney, gesturing at a table adorned with numerous spikes, most of them already impaling message sheets. "She's coming up this morning. I saw her at breakfast. Not taken to the king immediately?" "Does no one here pay attention to what is happening in the court we serve?" asked Mistress Finney. It was a rhetorical question, and no one in the mews dared to treat it any other way, remaining silent while hoping they looked suitably attentive. "The king and the Abhorsen left for their holiday this morning, a well-deserved one, their first holiday ever. You could all learn from their example. Hard work." She broke off as another hawk flew in, briefly settling on the landing perch before spying Mistress Finney. Upon seeing her, it immediately flew to her fist. "Hello, my beauty," said the falconer, forgetting her rant. "Come in from High Bridge, have you?" Lyrael hurried up the steps to the mews. She flexed her replacement hand as she did so, marvelling at how well it worked. When her own hand had been bitten off by the disreputable dog almost 7 months before, in order to save her life from the ravening power of Aranus, Samoth had promised to make her a replacement. He lived up to that promise and shown he was indeed a true inheritor of the Wallmaker's engineering ingenuity and magical craft, though it had taken him a long time to get it right with much tinkering and adjustment. It was only in the last few days that it felt entirely normal to Lyrael, really just like her own flesh and blood hand. It was mostly made from meteoric steel, but Sam had gilded the metal and, unasked, had added an extra layer of charter spells atop the ones that made the hand work and even feel like flesh, so it also glowed with a golden light. Already, many people were calling her Lyrael Golden Hand. Thank you. So that's a little taste of Golden Hand. So now we can have questions, and I will either attempt to answer them, sort of avoid them, obfuscate the whole issue, the usual things that happen in this circumstance. If you've got a question, just raise your hand and speak up, and I'll repeat the question so everyone else can hear it. Oh, we've got a microphone. We have a roving microphone, so raise your hand. Oh, we've got two. Oh, we have two. No, we have three. Two microphones, so... if you've got a question, please raise your hand and off we go.
Hi, Gar. Yes, good. Hello.
Hello.
So So I know that you get asked this question a lot, but still, not to the best of my knowledge, have I heard a definitive answer about the possibility of movies or TV series. What say you?
Sure. Well, I can tell you, I can tell you some news not about the Old Kingdom books, but there's some news from the Hollywood Reporter this morning, which was kind of aptly timed for this, very aptly timed for this tour, in terms of having sort of nice news to say to people. So this was in the Hollywood Reporter this morning. Once I find it. I did. Fox Animation and Blue Sky Studios adapting upcoming Garth Nix book, Frog Kisser. Get ready to pucker up, because 20th Century Fox Animation and Blue Sky Studios are teaming up to adapt Frog Kisser, the upcoming book from fantasy novelist Garth Nix. That would be me. The book is a fun take on the classic Princess Kiss curse-breaking fairy tale. So Frog Kisser has had like a dream run. It's not even out yet. It's out in February. That actually had kind of like the reverse experience of the Old Kingdom books in Hollywood, in that someone saw it at the Bologna Book Fair, an executive at Fox. They contacted my film TV agent, who contacted me. They made an offer, and everything was wrapped up in about 2 weeks, which is not normally what happens. I mean, in fact, it's completely the reverse. Whereas the Old Kingdom books have been backwards and forwards many times. I've done the rounds in Hollywood. It was set up at one point with Plan B, Brad Pitt's company. And I spent 3 weeks in LA going around all the studios with the Plan B people, not with Brad Pitt, but, you know. Though the executive, the head of Plan B, actually had a special ringtone for Brad Pitt on her phone. And we were in a meeting once at one of the studios and the special ringtone sounded. And she said, it's Brad, I've got to take this. And there was like total silence in the room. And it's like, God has called. So that was kind of interesting. It's actually Sabre's almost been made twice. It's been set up, things have been proceeding, you know, it's been into pre-visualization, director attached, screenwriter, everything, and then it's fallen over. In that particular instance, it fell over on a budgetary question, unfortunately, where one of the partners who was putting in a lot of money changed their mind. And of course, you know, if you're making it, at that time was probably going to be an $80 million film, and all of a sudden $20 million isn't there anymore. The whole thing goes away. Last year, it looked like it was going to be set up again, but that didn't work out. At the moment, I'm still talking to some people about a television series, an Old Kingdom television series. It wouldn't just be Sabriel. It would be, well, it would, if it worked, it would be more than that. But it is such, you know, a business that requires such massive investment and so many people to be involved that it, more often than not, nothing happens. And so I have nothing concrete I can tell you. Something concrete about Frog Kisser, fortunately, this morning. Though, of course, the deal was done months ago. But, yeah, nothing I can tell you about that, except that there's pretty much always talk. I'm always talking to somebody about it, and I'm hopeful that one day, you know, something will work out. I have also made it more difficult by wanting to be heavily involved. I'm not going to be involved in writing the Frog Kisser screenplay, which is a big plus from the studio's point of view. Don't want that Garth Nix character involved. No, they typically don't want the original author involved for a whole host of reasons, not least of which is if you're in front of them and they want to do something they know is morally reprehensible to the book. And if you're sort of like around, it makes it harder. So, you know, by preference, they always want you not to be there. And I've wanted to be involved in the Old Kingdom books. I trained as a screenwriter. I studied screenwriting at the University of Canberra. And, you know, I'm a successful novelist and I'm a very unsuccessful screenwriter because I've written a number of original screenplays which have never been made. But maybe they will be one day. But because of that, I've always wanted to be involved in the adaptation of particularly the Old Kingdom books. You know, I've got other books, I don't care. No, it's not true, I still care. But I'm less invested in them. But that does make it more difficult for something to happen. If I just wanted to sell the rights, I could have done so at several times, and I chose not to, and occasionally regretted it afterwards. But so that's the update. If that is still kind of the same amorphous answer, but I hope it gives you some idea. Yeah. Another question. We've got another question lurking somewhere. There we go. I have several friends here. I prepared with questions just in case. No.
Where do you get your awesome ideas from?
Where do I get my awesome ideas? Thank you. I'm glad you think they're awesome. Ideas actually come from all over the place. I have ideas, I guess, all the time, but they come from just thinking about. They come from thinking about things and asking yourself, what if this was different in some way? So, and I guess I've trained myself to a degree to ask those questions. So, for example, how do you go to school? Do you catch the bus to school or go in the car? On a bike. Okay, I used to ride my bike to school in Canberra too. So that's a pretty normal thing to do, ride your bike to school. I would think, what would happen if you were riding your bike to school and you're riding your bike and you got about two-thirds of the way there and you realised that it wasn't the way to school. Somehow you'd taken a wrong corner, even though you knew you hadn't, and you weren't going towards your school, you were going to somewhere else, some weird place you could see up ahead. Your school had been transformed, and maybe that school is a castle now. And then I'd think, well, who would live in the castle? How has the school disappeared and been replaced by a castle? And all of a sudden, you've got the basics to make a story. So I've taken something absolutely normal, it's part of my ordinary life, and I've started to try and ask myself, well, what if it was different? Now, what if it's been replaced by, what if the school looks the same, but when you go there, everybody's weirdly different? Like, I don't know, maybe their faces are on backwards, on the back of their heads. How weird would that be? How would you react? And I guess I nearly always think of myself as the main character, even if I'm not calling it, you know, it's not me, even if it's someone completely physically different. I still would think of, well, how would I feel if I arrived at school and everyone had their faces on backwards? But otherwise, it seemed perfectly normal. And then I started to think about why that would be. And then, you know, so that what if is a great question to ask to get ideas. And then what can happen next is a good question. What could happen next? You know, what is going on? You know, what is your character going to do? How are they going to react? I mean, if they completely freak out and run around screaming, how are these backwards face people going to react? And all of a sudden, the story can build up from there. But I get ideas for stories from you know, all kinds of places, the natural world. Sometimes, you know, I saw three magpies beating up each other the other day, and I just thought, what are they doing? Are they playing a game? Are they fighting? Are they magpies? You know, are they really magpies? And once you ask those questions of yourself, stories tend to flow from that. So ideas come from everywhere, but you need to work at them normally to make them into a story. You have to be open to taking them another step. An idea by itself is just raw material. You have to do something with it to make it into a story. So I think, yeah, just sort of keep your eyes open and think about stuff, and ideas will come in. I hope that kind of answers the question. Yep. All right, who's next? Our microphone. There we go.
Hi.
Hello.
Are you going to Conflux this weekend?
I'm not, I'm afraid.
Oh, but you timed it so perfectly.
I know, I'm off to the US on Monday morning, so...
That's Monday, like, Conflux is, like, is that tomorrow? I'll be there from 10 a.m.
And it's my son's birthday on Saturday.
Okay, yeah. So my actual question is, I haven't actually read The Frog Kisser. I didn't even know it existed.
Well, it's not out till February.
Yeah, so. But I was interested to see that it was a, you know, kind of historical romance. Do you read a lot of historical romances?
Kisser or Newt's Emerald?
Oh, sorry, Newt's Emerald.
Newt's Emerald, yeah.
Wrong one.
Yeah, Newt's Emerald is really an homage to Georgia Heyer.
I was hoping you would say that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Georgia Heyer's Regency romances. It's a Regency romance with magic.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually originally wrote it as a straight historical, but the magic stuff crept in, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually have great difficulty writing very completely realistic material. I do try sometimes. There's nearly always some element of the fantastic creeps in some way. Mm-hmm. And in fact, of the many, many things I've written, I can really only think of two examples which are not, you know, which are actually just straight realism, mm-hmm. Or as real as you can be when writing fiction. So, yes, I love historical fiction. I love Georgia De Haye's Regency romances. I love some other people's, not all of them, of course. Mm-hmm. But I always try and keep a very open mind about genres in general. So I love some romance. I don't love all of it. I love some science fiction and fantasy, not all of it.
Yeah.
I don't dismiss any genre by the examples I don't like. I think of the examples that I do love. And I think there's brilliant books to be found in all categories, all genres. I read a lot of non-fiction. So, you know, I think it's... I judge books individually, not by where they rest on a shelf.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely check it out because I love Georgette Heyer as well. I was rereading Sabriel as well the other day, and because I'm starting to write myself. And, like, one of the things that I struggle with is, like, getting really beautiful kind of poetic language into my novels. I tend to be very literal, and I don't even have that many similes. I have to really work for it. I was wondering if you could, give me any ideas on how to generate that more.
Well, one of the greatest ways to improve your prose is to read it aloud. Mm-hmm. And reading it aloud will reveal the flaws, and it will also sometimes the rhythm and the euphony, you know, the sound of the words will be either lacking or you'll feel it in them. And if you read things aloud, it's a very good step to then revising it to make it better. So I think that's a very good tool. Also, when things just don't work, reading aloud is a great way to work out that actually, you know, that's dead on the page. It needs to be revised. But you can nearly always revise, even if what your initial draft you think is pedestrian or dead. You don't have to scrap it necessarily. You can probably revise it. Pardon me, into something that works, and maybe you can revise it into something that's very good. The other thing I would do is I would read a lot of really great stuff. I would read poetry. I would read books where you really love the writing, not just the story, and you'll be equipping yourself, you know, to do it yourself. You learn to write to a degree by reading as well as by actually doing it yourself. So the more widely you read and the more you read different material, the more, you know, you're putting into your tool chest to work yourself. Yep.
Thank you.
And keep doing it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, Garth.
Oh, where am I looking? Oh, up the back. Thank you.
Hello. So growing up in the UK, I always gave your characters accents from around the UK. What kind of accents did you give your characters? Were they all Australian? G'day, old man. How's it going?
G'day, mate, said the Abhorson. I've heard you got some dead buggers down the back paddock. I'll just get my bells out of the ute and I'll go sort them out. I think probably the regional accents. I don't write regional accents phonetically in my books because I think that often is a barrier to people reading them if they don't understand them or don't know them. But I also think probably that readers supply their own accents to characters. They actually think they will sound a particular way from, you know, the sort of standard English that's in the books. So in the same way that I've talked to readers and they've said, you know, I liked how XYZ has black hair or has... I love the description of her nose. And I think, well, actually, there is no description of her nose. The reader has supplied that themselves. I think in the same way that if you make the prose transparent enough and fluent enough, then you ought to supply the voice. You'll hear the voices how you want to hear them, you know, in your head, as opposed to trying to phonetically, you know, make them work on the page, which can be a barrier to other people. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Oh, good. Thank you. I mean, I think regional accents are very, very interesting. And one of the things I do is in my word choices, I do use obscure words which might need to be looked up sometimes, but that sound right. And if it sounds right, it will work even if people don't know what it means. And editors often are very resistant to those words, and they want you to change them. But I think particularly when you're creating a fantasy world and you're trying to make it feel real, it's very important that the names and the words sound right. And whether you know what they mean or not, they have to sound right. And again, saying them aloud is a big part of that, of making them work. Yep. Another question?
Hello. So you write for a couple of different target markets in terms of age. I'd probably say you've written stuff for probably the 8 to 10 group, the 10 to 12, and the more explicitly young adult to stuff young adult, it's just fiction. How do you decide, or at what stage in developing a story do you work out where you're targeting a particular book or a particular story?
That's a good question, because I actually don't target them at a particular audience. The target is me. And it's me as I am at the time of writing. So right now I'm 53. So Golden Hand was written for a 51-year-old, 52-year-old. Like 51, I guess I was when I was writing, 50, 51. But it was also written for me as I was when I was every preceding age as well, all the way back to what I would call the entry-level age, the age where I would have been able to read the book and also to appreciate it, because they're not necessarily the same thing. And I think the entry-level age for something like Golden Hand, for me, and if you're a sophisticated reader, which I was, and many people are, it's probably about 12 or 13. But that doesn't mean it's for 12 or 13-year-olds. It means that that's when you could begin to read it. I also think that at 12 or 13, I would have read a book like this and I would have read the top level of the story and I wouldn't have necessarily got any of the other stuff, which I hope is there, because I think all good books have multiple layers. They have layers of story and meaning. And this is how you can come back and reread them when you're older. And you can go back to read childhood classics, for example, and discover that the story that you loved is still there and you totally connect with it. But it's like, oh, wow, there's all this other stuff it offers as well. And you may have a different experience of it. But that said, I do think about who it's going to be marketed to. Usually, once I've decided that it's going to be the thing I'm going to write next, because I have to tell the publisher it's going to be something you can sell as a YA book or a children's book, even though to me those labels are not the most important thing. They are, all those categories are about how to sell books. And they're about how to get the book to the biggest initial audience before it spreads out. The biggest initial audience might be adults, it might be young adults, it might be children, but the good ones will always go further. They'll spread more widely. And normally, I guess, when I'm thinking about it, what I'm going to write next, I will have probably been thinking about it for 2 or 3 years, sometimes much longer. I'll have made some notes about it. I will have written probably a prologue or the first chapter, even though I might not use it. Most of my books, often I do end up using the prologue or the first chapter. Some of them I've written one, but I haven't used it. But it's helped me work out what's happening. And normally about that stage, I will write an outline. I've said before that I do kind of Zen outlines because I never follow them. I write them in order to not follow them. But I need to write them to sort of begin working out the story. And also, once you're an established author, you sell a book, you do a deal with a publisher on unwritten books. They'll give you a contract for a book to deliver in a year and pay you in advance and so on. And that's based upon usually an outline and some of the material. And normally I'll do 2 or 3 chapters. And that's when I've done those 2 or 3 chapters. And the outline, which I won't follow, and so will bear no relation to the book later on, is when I think, okay, the main initial market for this book will be YA or adult or children's, And that's what it will feel like to most people it should be. But I don't think it's... I'd like it not to be restrictive. And I think all the best books in any category have much broader appeal. And, you know, young adult is a particularly... As it's changed over the years, has become a particularly problematic in that area because, in fact, lots of studies have shown that the majority of readers of young adult books are, in fact, older adults. But they're still probably sort of, 18 to 35 is probably the core audience. But there are some young adult books sold as young adult where the core audience is 12 to 15, say. And it just really depends on the kind of book. And some books will appeal to particular demographics and so on. I don't think about that when I'm thinking about what I'm going to write. It's only when it comes time for me to sell it to a publisher and then when the publisher's going to have to sell it as well is when all those categorisations come into effect. And I think it's important not to think too much about that because once you try and second-guess what you think people want, then you start trying to write what you think people want. It often doesn't end as well as you would hope. I personally believe, and this comes not just as an author, but from when I was an editor, I was an agent, I was a bookseller long ago. I think the books that you really believe in, the story you most want to tell, is the one you should always write and then work out what the hell to do with it, not the other way around. Though, of course, that can work as well. But the ones that last the longest, the books that stick around, I firmly believe are always the ones where the author really wanted to tell that story and let the other people work out how to sell it. Another question, we got any more? How are we going?
Hello, how's it going?
Good. I'm still standing.
Oh, look, that's a good start. You mentioned earlier a couple of things that you've done. Like you trained in screenwriting and you've been an editor and that kind of thing. At what point did you realise or decide or something like that you wanted to be a writer, or did you just kind of fall into it and end up where you are now?
Sure. No, I was always a writer as well. I actually decided I wanted to become a serious writer. I was always telling stories and making stuff up. And I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 19 and I was travelling in the United Kingdom. I went over the classic thing. I worked for 11 months and one day here in Canberra. I was a pay clerk with the Department of Aviation. And my plan was to work for a year to save money to then go travelling. But I did find it very dispiriting being a pay clerk, particularly in that area, because all we did was fill out computer forms. So I can still remember some of the codes. 10010 was to change someone's salary. And so we'd be coding these. It was kind of Dickensian, really. We'd be just coding these lines of code on triplicate forms, which would then go off to a mainframe computer. And on the 11th month and one day, I decided I can't do this anymore. I can't cope. Now, fortunately, at that stage, I was actually in charge of H to S of the Department of Aviation, which included myself. So I actually processed myself out. I did my whole resignation and so on. And then I got one of my friends to sign off on it, and I walked out, which made my boss so furious. But I literally felt like my life was being drained out of me by these forms. So I tried to do the 12 months, but I couldn't. In retrospect, that was actually an incredibly childish and silly thing to do, but I had to do it. And I went travelling, and when I was in the UK, I reread lots of my favourite books, lots of children's books, where they were set. So I read The Eagle of the Ninth on Hadrian's Wall. I read Swallows and Amazons in the Lake District. I read Alan Garner's The Wizard of Brisingamen in Cheshire. I went looking for Fundendelve, found Catalan the Wizard, had a bit of a chat. I did not find the cave. I did not find Fundendelve. But, I re-experienced those books in their landscape. And I decided I want to try and do something like that myself. And I started writing a novel. And I actually found it not that long ago. I wrote it in notebooks. I wrote it longhand, and I also bought a typewriter. This is a long time ago, a Silver Reed typewriter, and I wrote some stories as well. And in fact, I wrote the first story I ever sold when I was travelling around on that typewriter. And I wrote that book. I wrote two-thirds of that novel, but I didn't finish it. And I did find it the other day, and it wasn't absolutely terrible. No, it wasn't awful. It wasn't very good, but it wasn't awful. I think I could have fixed it up, and if I'd finished it, maybe I would have got started even earlier. But I'd made that decision that I wanted to be a writer. But I've always had a sort of very practical side of my mind as well as the imaginative side, and so I've been reading a lot about publishing and writing, and even in that pre-internet age, you could still find a lot of books about being a writer and being published and so on. And all of them said, it is very, very hard and you'll make no money. And so I thought, okay, all right, I'm going to keep writing, but I'd better plan to actually have a day job. I better equip myself in some other way. I needed a university degree. So I came back here. I went to the University of Canberra and I thought, okay, I need a degree so I can have a ticket to show to get a better job. But I want to do something I'm interested in. And at that stage, what was then Canberra CAE offered the only writing degree in the whole of Australia. I mean, they all do now. And so I thought, well, that's perfect. I want to keep writing. I'll do the writing degree. And I'll get a degree which can get me a day job. And, you know, we'll just see what happens. So from 19, I decided I wanted to be a writer. But I also had the common sense to realise I would need a day job. I went and got my degree. I did screenwriting in the theatre, which actually didn't really help the employability. But afterwards, I worked in a bookstore and I worked in publishing because I love books and I love the business of books. So I was always writing, but I was hedging my bets by working in publishing, which I did with, you know, for the next sort of 20 years, really, with some a bit of a sideways venture into PR for IT firms where I used my writing skills, and I got paid much, much more than in publishing. I'd always wanted to be a writer, but yeah, I did that backstop. And I have been very lucky because, you know, most writers can't make a living. It is very hard, and you need your day job often. And the thing to bear in mind is that even very successful writers often keep their day jobs because it's better for their mental health as well and how they arrange their time. I mean, I wrote half my novels, 14 or 15 novels, while I had very busy day jobs. It is perfectly possible. I was lucky to have the luxury later on to be able to be a full-time writer. I pretty much planned it from when I was 19, and I've been lucky enough that it all kind of worked out. But I also love working in publishing. I love the business of books. And I still might, you know, one day, I hope not, but you never know, I might have to go back to working in publishing, and I'd go back to being a literary agent, my last job in publishing, and help other writers, you know, get published, because it's still good to have a backstop, even when things are going well. You just, you know, but it's perfectly possible to be a successful writer and do a lot of other stuff as well, and have some other much more likely to work out job. Yeah. Might take one more question, because then I'll read a little bit from Frog Kisser, give you a little special sneak preview.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah. Yes.
I'm curious, when you were a young person at Turner Primary School and later in high school, what were you reading and what were your favourite books?
Sure. Well, at Turner Primary and Lynham High and Dixon College, I'm just establishing my Canberra credentials here, University of Canberra. I mean, many of the books you would expect, and many of the books which are very common to many, many current fantasy writers. So, obviously, Tolkien was a very big influence, Lord of the Rings. I first read Lord of the Rings when I was, I think, 11. But I can actually claim to have read it possibly younger than anyone ever, because my mother read it when she was pregnant with me. So I like to sort of claim I absorbed it in utero. You always meet people say, I read Lord of the Rings when I was 9, and you know, I was 7 or whatever, and I read the Bible upside down when I was 5. I say, yeah, I read the Lord of the Rings before I was born. So Tolkien, I mentioned Alan Garner, Rosemary Sutcliffe, her historical novels. I love historical fiction. Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov, you know, the sort of science fiction greats of that time. Roger Zelazny, Philip K. Dick. There's a sort of the children's classics, and then there's the science fiction and fantasy classics. Some people who had an enormous influence on me would include people like Ursula Le Guin, Robin McKinley, As soon as you asked that question, my mind went completely blank. But I'm thinking of my bookshelves. Henry Treece, another historical writer. Also Australian authors like Ivan Southall. I loved his books. There's a lot. But you could mention almost probably any significant... Dinah Wynne Jones, another very important one. You could mention almost any significant children's writer of, the 60s and 70s, and sometimes before, and they would, they'd be a part of my reading. But also people like Dickens. I'm a huge fan of Charles Dickens. Alexandre Dumas, I'm a huge fan of The Three Musketeers and everything else. Jane Austen. I'm not such a fan of the Brontes, even though I live in Bronte, I should be, but not such a fan of the Brontes, but I love Jane Austen. I regularly reread Georgette Heyer, who I mentioned, though not her mysteries. Yeah, it's kind of weird, It is weird. In the mystery writers, I love Dorothy Sayers, interestingly, with the mystery writers like Dorothy Sayers, I don't care about the crime or how it's solved. It's just the people. So I love Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane. I love their relationship, and I forget the details of what they're meant to be working out or who got murdered or whatever. It's just those characters are so fascinating. Marjorie Allingham, another one of that era of detective story writers. The Americans, Raymond Chandler. Many. I've always read very widely, and I read a lot of them when I was quite young, and they just stuck with me. And I reread too. I love rereading. I go back to authors and reread their work. And I think, they all influence you in different ways, even small ways that people might not realise, it sneaks into the books in some fashion or other. I hope that begins to answer the question. It'd be a very, very long answer, I guess. Maybe one final question, one lucky last question, someone who hasn't already asked a question. And I'll let the microphone wielder choose. Writing strong female characters. I always find it kind of interesting people ask me about that. I mean, obviously it's because I'm a man writing female characters, though I always have male characters as well. But I do find it interesting, no one ever asks me, quite commonly say, how do you create strong female characters? They don't ask, how do you write completely made-up bizarre monsters that do not exist and you cannot observe in real life? They ask me about people that I spend my life with and have grown up with. So it's always a kind of interesting question because, of course, if you are interested in people around you and observe them, and also not just in real life, but in created works as well. I think all the raw material is there. With Sabriel, I've sort of, I think, falsely got credit for having, an early, female protagonist in young adult fantasy where it wasn't done that much when it first came out in 1995. And various reviewers and so on were very complimentary about why I'd done that. But I say it's kind of false because it was really a happy accident because I wrote the prologue where Sabriel is born thinking I was going to write about her father. I knew I wanted to write about necromancers. I wanted to write about good necromancers because I wanted to try and, reverse some stereotypes. I wanted to turn that stereotype around, but I wasn't thinking about reversing gender stereotypes at that point. But when I was writing the prologue and Sabriel was born, I suddenly thought, oh yeah, she's much more interesting. I want to write about her. And then I wrote about her. And as I do with all my characters, she's the beginnings of her. I took little bits and pieces from people that I knew and I sort of meld them together to make a kind of Frankenstein's monster, but much more attractive. But then they grow themselves through the course of the story. And I guess that's a long way around of actually saying that what you suggested is that they find me is correct. Because I don't, typically when I'm starting a story, I don't think about whether it's going to be a male protagonist or a female protagonist or something that's neither. I just start writing and they just show up, which is handy. but yeah, I don't actively think about it that much. Possibly I should. I mean, I do think it's something that is worth examining. One of the things I do deliberately do is I don't assign particular characteristics to a gender in terms of, you know, the women can't fight or whatever. You know, the women and the men are equally capable in all ways in nearly all my books. In the way that I think our society tries to be and should be, you know, an equal opportunity society. The Old Kingdom certainly is. Does that answer the question up to a point? Thank you. All right, well, I might read a little bit from Frogkisser now, so give you a sneak preview. This is actually the Scholastic advanced reading copy. The Allen and Unwin cover is almost exactly the same, but they took the buy off. So instead of Frogkisser by Garth Nix, it's just Frogkisser, Garth Nix. Garth Nix is a Frogkisser. And I wish I'd brought one with me, but the other really great thing that Scholastic did when they put these out is that they also put out a lip balm with the cover on it, a little Frogkisser lip balm, which is actually completely appropriate for this book because it is actually mostly about a quest to find the ingredients for a transmogrification reversal lip balm, which the heroine needs to transform her sister's prince from being a frog back into a prince, because her sister's a little bit flighty. And you know, true love is the best transmogrification reversal that there is, but if you haven't got that, you've got to fall back on the ointment. So so I'm going to read a little bit from Frogkisser. Chapter 1, in which Morven's den home is turned into a frog. The scream was very loud and went on for a very long time. Princess Anya, who was reading in the castle library, ignored it at first but eventually lifted her head from her book to listen. "That sounds bad," said Gottfried the librarian in his quavering, high-pitched voice. Disturbed by the sound, he immediately turned into an owl and began to vomit up a nicely packaged parcel of bones from the mouse he'd had for breakfast. It was something he did when under stress. Turning into an owl, that is. The vomiting just came with the shape. "It does," Anya frowned. It was her older sister Morven screaming, which was not unusual, but the intensity and duration of this particular scream was quite out of the ordinary. Anya shut her book with an emphatic thump and latched it closed, since it was a copy of The Adventures of a Sorceress Typesetter's Apprentice, and the words inside could otherwise climb off the page and go wandering around the library. In fact, there were still several words missing from an earlier reading, including the particularly troublesome pair of instantly and forthwith, which Gottfried now believed had escaped the castle altogether or had been eaten by one of the dogs. The screaming continued as Anya hurried out of the library, across the inner courtyard, to the main part of the castle and up the private stair to her sister's rooms. Morven was the heir to the kingdom, at least theoretically. The sisters had not one, but two step-parents, so the matter of lineage was a complicated one. This is one of the most frequent questions Anya was asked later in life. How is it possible to have two step-parents and no actual parents? The answer ended up being rather straightforward. Their mother, who had been the ruling queen of the little kingdom of Trelawnia, had died when Morven was 6 and Anya was 3. Their father remarried a year later to Countess Iselda, so they had a stepmother, who was expected to be quite evil, but mainly turned out to be a very enthusiastic botanist. She was not interested in the children at all, for good or ill, only in plants. But then their father died a year after his marriage to Countess Iselda, and their stepmother married Duke Ricard. So the girls had two step-parents. Their stepmother, the botanist, wasn't a huge problem, but as it turned out, their step-stepfather was evil and wanted to be the king. Though Morven should by rights be crowned when she turned 16 in 3 months' time, it was fairly certain Duke Ricard would somehow prevent this from happening. "Perhaps he already has," thought Anya, as she knocked on Morven's door. Not waiting for an answer, she went straight in. As expected, her sister was lying on a lounge in her receiving room, screaming at the ceiling and kicking her legs. Her maid, Bethany, was sitting on a stool nearby knitting. Large strands of the wool she'd stuffed in her ears hung down her neck. Anya leaned over her sister and waited until two things happened at the same time. Her presence was registered through the veil of tears, and Morven needed to take a breath. "What's happened?" asked Anya. Morven stopped screaming and started sobbing. Step-stepfather? Guessed Anya. It was far more likely to be step-stepfather than stepmother. Anya hadn't even seen Iselda for the past month. She'd gone somewhere far off to collect a rare shrub or a sapling. Anya raised an eyebrow. She could normally translate Morven's sobbing speech, but this was beyond her. "Turned," said Morven at last. "Turned? Denham." Morven started crying even harder, so hard the tears were flying horizontally out of her eyes. Anya stood back a bit, impressed that this was even possible. Rickard has turned Denham into something, translated Anya. One of the greater disadvantages of having Duke Rickard as an evil step-stepfather was that he was an accomplished sorcerer. Prince Denham was the latest, totally amazing love beyond any possibility of measuring of Morven's life. The son of one of the kings from the petty kingdoms near the coast, Denham was a thoroughly nice young man, one of the better princes in the continuous cavalcade that came to the castle to woo Morven. And he liked Denham and thought he was unlucky to have soft, wavy blonde hair and blue eyes of the sort that made Morven fall in love with people. As Morven was remarkably beautiful herself, with her raven hair and snow-white skin and warm chocolate eyes, young men she fell in love with usually fell in love back, at least until she decided she liked someone else better. The spurned princes usually retired to their homes to write bad poetry and brood by the fire, or they went on a quest and in the process discovered that they also liked someone else better, or they got eaten by a dragon. Whether at home writing poetry, embraced by a new love, or in a dragon's stomach, they didn't come back. Getting turned into something was unusual. Denham must have been foolish enough to try to talk to Rickard over breakfast, or maybe even ask for Morven's hand in marriage, which to the Duke would have been the equivalent of volunteering for immediate transformation. If Morven was married, she would have allies, and it would be even more difficult to get rid of her. And without her gone, Rickard could never become the king. "What has Rickard turned Denham into?" asked Anya. "A frog, said Anya. "How unimaginative. Typical. Stop crying, Morven. It's not the end of the world. Just kiss him and turn him back." Thank you. Okay, so possibly the most exciting part of the evening, the draw for the bell charm. So has everyone got their raffle ticket? Has anyone not got a raffle ticket? Bad luck. No, I'm joking. Let me find my raffle ticket book. I'll run it. Who hasn't got one? Oh, someone. Here we go. Here we are. I'll run it. Like sale of centuries. Here we go.
While Garth gives out the last of his raffle tickets, I'll take the opportunity to thank everyone for coming to the library. It's always fascinating to have authors come to the library and hear how they craft their work.